Welcome to the Enneagram Global Summit, where top experts are sharing key insights that illuminate the nine essential pathways to your true nature. Share this event with your friends and family, and come join us on Facebook at the Shift Network. And now your host, Jessica Dibb, founder of the Inspiration Consciousness School.
Welcome, everyone. This session is entitled The Enneagram and God Talk, and our faculty is Father Richard Rohr. Father Richard is a globally recognized ecumenical teacher bearing witness to the universal awakening within Christian mysticism and the perennial tradition. He is a Franciscan priest and founder of the Center for Action and Contemplation in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Father Richard is the author of numerous books, including Everything Belongs, Adam's Return, The Naked Now, Breathing Underwater, Falling Upward, Immortal Diamond, and Eager to Love, The Alternative Way of Francis of Assisi. His newest book is The Divine Dance, The Trinity, and Your Transformation, which he has written with Mike Morrell. He's also the academic dean of the Living School for Action and Contemplation. Father Richard, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, I'm honored, sincerely. Very glad to talk with you. I hope and I'm sure we're going to be able to address some good things. Thank you.
Well, that's a very good place to start, is with the word good and the idea of goodness, because, you know, there's a saying that there are no atheists in a foxhole. You know, in a foxhole, you're like, I don't even know if you're there, God, but if you are. And I think that my own experience, you know, the deep honor that I've had of working with people's innermost parts of themselves, their deepest desire of their soul and their deepest fears, is that everyone wants to awaken to what is really possible inside of them, and everyone feels some possibility of being connected to something larger than themselves. And throughout time, you know, we've used the word God, sometimes goddess or the divine, or there are different ways and different traditions. But I'm excited about this conversation with you because I feel like this is what matters most to a human being, is to be connected to something larger than, you know, or to feel the contact with that which is more than just our little separated self. And the word God has been used, and to reclaim it for, you know, its natural nobility and have it point to the real thing would just be mana. And I know you have been an incredible pioneer and of walking that path with yourself and with others. So I'm so glad to have this topic included on this amazing summit.
Well, that's a wonderful start right there. Thank you.
You're totally welcome. So why, you know, tell us a little bit about your sense of God and God talk, and why the Enneagram is so helpful to this process.
Okay, let me just dive in, and I hope I say something helpful. And there's no one right way to answer this, but let's just call God, for our purposes here, the interior binding force of the universe. I speak of God as the great connector, that which connects and makes this a coherent universe. You know, the word universe, I was the last generation of priests that had to learn Latin, but it means to turn around one thing. Now, you don't have to agree that there's one thing, but it does give coherence. It does give a meaning, purpose, direction, intelligent design, if I can even be allowed to use that word, which some people don't like. But we do have to recognize that, you know, 99% of humanity since the beginning of time has felt the need for some kind of coherence. Now, the trouble is, and they define God in, of course, a thousand different ways, and there have been many names for God, and there always will be. But because they were so misused, And we ended up picturing God. I address this in my most my last book, The Divine Dance, as, you know, an old man with a white beard sitting on a throne. You know, the Latin word, again, Deus, is a direct transliteration of Zeus. And that's no accident. Basically, the notion of Zeus comes so easily to the Christian, or not the Christian, the human conscience, that despite the supposed Christian understanding of God as Trinity, in other words, God as a relationship itself, God as communion, God as an event of communion, God is more a verb than a noun, we pretty much, despite our formal belief in God as a relationship, pretty much fell back into the old man on the throne, which took the contemporary form of Santa Claus. And that's what so many people have simply, thank God, grown beyond, this idea of a deity that had to be placated or pleased. And, you know, from many of the texts that a lot of us were raised on, apparently he, and he was always a he in this worldview, was upset much of the time. So this created not just an incoherent world, but a sort of scary world. And so I actually see it as an advance in human consciousness that we can't live with that anymore. You know, even Paul's first sermon on the Areopagus in Athens, when he's talking to the great intellectual Greeks, he defines God, this is in Acts 17, if you know the scripture, God is the one in whom we live and move and have our being. Now, if we had presented God as the one in whom we live and move and have our being, the foundation of all that is life and love and goodness, as you mentioned before, I don't think we would have inaugurated the kind of pushback we have. You know, formal atheism is largely, and this is, I'm told is true, is largely a phenomenon of Christian countries or formerly Christian countries. And we've got to take responsibility for that, that we define God, and the other two religions of the book did the same thing, all three monotheistic religions. We created a God that for the modern and postmodern mind is unthinkable. It doesn't cohere. It doesn't make sense. So that's the first thing we Christians have to do. Take responsibility for, in part, creating the problem, but now taking responsibility for also undoing the problem. Because I find if you give people a good spirituality, a good theology of God, most people are just highly delighted. They have nothing to push against, you know. They have nothing to fight. They have nothing to resent. And it frees them from their own negative energy, if that is the case. So does any of that make sense?
Absolutely. It not only makes sense, it's tremendously instructive and inspiring. And
well,
really
I hope so.
Gives a path forward. When you talked about the Paul thing and that God is that thing that we move in, and I just was thinking about little children. My sense has always been that, you know, we talk a lot about, for instance, physical abuse or emotional abuse, sexual abuse, but I think some of the spiritual abuse that happens on our planet is that it's natural for us when we're young to have a direct contact with this thing that we are calling God, but then we sort of educate or discipline or guide our children away from that direct contact and put something between it, like a mediating force that you sort of have to prove yourself, you know, to get back to this thing. And I think that's been
that tremendous. You just spoke largely the first chapter of my next book, which I just finished last week. That very point you made, I think my years of spiritual direction, when you talk with people, they'll often go to a pianissimo voice, and with a little bit of embarrassment, talking about, you know, when I was a child, I believed this. Now, of course, they expressed it in a pre-rational way, which, of course, we grow beyond the pre-rational stage. But we don't realize that pre-rational intuition, which the child almost always has, is the laying the groundwork for the trans-rational. But, of course, you got to go through the rational in between. And that's where most of Western civilization, most of Western secular civilization is at that rational in-between, afraid of the trans-rational because they haven't experienced it, and calling all religion pre-rational, which it actually isn't. If it's mature religion, it's trans-rational. Does that language make sense at all?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, good.
Most of our listeners. So we're really saying even more, this is all a foundation for understanding this thing of how the word God started to be misused by human fear and human ego, and really this is the possibility of reclaiming real God talk, you know, the talk of the actual thing itself, the coherent, unifying peace that even as children we have the sense of. And, you know, so I'm just thrilled that you're doing this work, and thank you so much.
Well, you're most welcome. I think it's so important because not only was this God defined as separate, he wasn't the ground of being, he wasn't the very nature of love, the one in whom we moved, but it got worse. In much of mainline Christianity, he was presented as a torturer, an eternal torturer of his enemies, of people who didn't like him. I keep using him because he's always a masculine form in this understanding. So you see why the psyche, the mature psyche, had to react against it. Because if there's a sadist at the center of the universe who not only dislikes his enemies but punishes them, it's an unsafe world. It really is. And you speak of those children. Can you imagine when you're in the little third grader and first hear talk of going to hell for all eternity if you don't like this God? I mean, you've just set up a form of, well, you alluded to it again. You're always ahead of me. I call it, you know, spiritual PTSD. And that your fear resides in the lowest level of the brainstem. And you never really get beyond, and we find this in spiritual direction, you never really get beyond this foundational anxiety, fear, dislike of God. Because who would want a friend like that? I mean, even your worst enemy wouldn't punish their enemies for all eternity, would they? And yet we've allowed God to be defined this way? Absurd. Absolutely absurd. And I'm standing on very orthodox grounds in saying that. If it's worth throwing in here, so people don't just think I'm some kind of liberal, edgy priest, you know, I'm still in good standing. I've passed interviews with the Vatican and local bishops. And they know this is orthodox. It is not edgy, heretical teaching. So forgive me for tooting my horn, but I think people need to know this, that on the edge. Yeah.
Yeah, I think they need to know that, not just to take in this interview more fully, which that it does help with that, but also to feel inspired that if the Vatican and other places are talking to you and they're in alignment with that, that really lets us know that there are some potential pathways here to really heal this, you know, chaos that has happened around the human ego kind of co-opting the whole God thing and the spiritual path thing. So that I'm so glad that you shared that.
You know, I might as well mention, this investigation was done about 15 years ago, but to this group, it's worth mentioning. Their first question, I had to answer about 8 or 10 questions, which I apparently answered to their satisfaction. But the first one was on the Enneagram. So a lot of people were, criticizing me because of this tool that they thought was pagan or New Age or heretical. And apparently I gave a good enough, I don't even remember what I said anymore. I don't think I have those papers. But my first thing was a defense of the Enneagram as a marvelous tool. And they accepted my answer.
Oh, Richard, these are such miraculous things to hear about. Thank you so much. And that maybe is a good segue for me to bring together the Enneagram and one go back to one other thing you said, and then we can kind of delve into the Enneagram, is that you were talking about, you know, God being seen as a torturer, you know, somebody who
yes.
could have power over you. And I think that is a reflection of the human ego's sense of power, and that power
right.
is power over something rather than power with something or the power of something. And so, you know, of course, this brings us to point eight, which is the beginning of the body center, that, you know, what is actual power from God's power, the unifying power, the coherent power, that it would never be power over something. So I think this would be a wonderful place to start about how you're using the Enneagram to help people in their spiritual journey to God. I know, and I'll say one more thing, which is
sure.
that for myself, for whom the notion of God somehow I just always had the sense of it as that something that I am moving in and everything is moving in all the time. But I remember when I found my Enneagram type, I became aware of how poverty-stricken, not in the good St. Francis way, but how much I had lost of my contact with God, because my type had a preference for experiencing God in certain ways and not in others. So it became this amazing doorway for me to have a boundless experience of what God is. And so it would be wonderful if you could share with people how you're using the Enneagram to support people in their journey to God.
Wow, again, you're the perfect interviewer. What you just said is right on and parallels my own experience. You know, I think the reason over the years I've been so graciously invited to a lot of these events is because I did learn it very early. So in 1973, my Jesuit spiritual director in Cincinnati, who was guiding me, and I remember, this was fall of 73, as I remember. I thought, my goodness, this man, how does he know me so well? He must have the gift of reading souls, which was Catholic language at that time, that certain people could read the soul. Well, I felt he was reading my soul. Now, so for the first months I was with him, he never used the word Enneagram, but finally, 6 months, a year into it, when I think I asked him, how are you so insightful about knowing how I operate? And he said, well, Richard, you're a one. And I said, what? And then he subsequently, in the next few weeks, taught me the Enneagram. And I can still remember, and also told me, at that time, it was still a secret, only to be used by spiritual directors and taught to spiritual directors. In 1973, there were no books on the Enneagram. There were no recordings. That's probably hard for you to believe now, but the secret was pretty well kept because they were afraid it would be trivialized and become a parlor game, which in some ways happened. But at any rate, I remember driving back to my Franciscan house in Cincinnati from the Jesuit University where he lived, and I'm sure I looked like a deer caught in the headlights. Do you? I'm sure I was just staring straight forward on the street, because I realized I had been given just an immense gift that took away my blinders, that I, to put it, you know, forthrightly, I felt, and this wasn't said now in a self-hating way, but a liberating way. If you know the one, which I'm sure you do, you know, we're righteous, we're zealous, we're hardworking, we're far too serious. But I realized I went to the seminary for the wrong reason. I certainly became celibate for the wrong reason. I was trying to save the world, which I still am, I'm afraid, for the wrong reason. All out of this inordinate righteous zeal, this over-seriousness, that I grew up so quickly. I was a little adult as a little boy. I'm sure trying to get my mother's love, who was a bit of a taskmaster. She loved me very much. I was her favorite, but she was still a taskmaster. And a little boy wants to keep that, of course. So I think I gained a survival mode for being in this world. And it became my Enneagram type, of course. Now, here I am, and I'm in my 75th year, and I still see it. I still see, probably the way I'm talking right now, it always has a authority, a definitiveness to it. And that's been part of my gift as a preacher and teacher. So it's helped me to bring clarity. We ones tend to be good teachers because we're searching for the right word, the clear word. So I can't deny it's allowed me to write my books and so forth and talk. But it's also my biggest burden. Because I, you know, the medieval Catholic spoke of weeping over your sins. And I remember when I used to read that in the lives of the saints, it seemed like such a hyperbole or such a histrionic exaggeration. But I'll tell you, I can understand it now. It's not done out of self-hatred, but out of sympathy for the self, that I can calmly now see, there you go, Richard, you're into that righteous thing, you're into that judgmental thing, you're into that zealous, overly zealous thing. So this, I had to go deep with that, and I'm sure I swam in that ocean for 3 solid years, just as it became clearer and clearer. I used it in this closed community in Cincinnati where I was the pastor of this lay community. And there we could use it because we were sort of closed off, you know, it's still a secret. It was only in the mid-80s when the book started coming out, Helen Palmer's and others, that I said, okay, the secret's out. And I made my first set of recordings. In fact, I had just moved here to Albuquerque. I think it was 86. And I made a set of recordings then. So ever since then, I got invited a lot to teach it. I don't anymore because I don't travel and teach much anymore. That's why I'm not with you now, I'm sorry to say. But I still have privately, personally, one-on-one, used it all over the world. And not just for individuals, but a lot of people don't recognize what a gift the Enneagram is for discerning the energy of a culture, of a group, mm-hmm. of a institution, you know, because they do take on too much one energy, too much eight energy, you might see in a lot of social justice communities, you know, too much two energy in a community of nurses, it's helped me to know how to address groups in ways that appear to be helpful to them. So I can't thank God enough for introducing me so young and so early to this genius tool that, you know, it's not psychology, it's not anthropology, it's not spirituality, but it's all of them. and that's why some psychologists fight it. They say it's not scientific. Some theologians fight it and say it's not Christian. Some anthropologists don't know where to place it. But I think that's its genius, is that it's clearly coming from what you quoted early as the perennial tradition. We call it the wisdom tradition. The wisdom tradition is the deeper stream that people at mature levels in religion and outside of religion very often have access to or discover. From that level, we can give people a lot of permission, a lot of freedom, and a lot of challenge. And that's one of the reasons I, as a one, trust the Enneagram, because it isn't just flattering the ego, as so many self-help tools do, but it really critiques the ego and lets us all see how blind we are. Forgive me, that's my laundry. It's done now. Telling me I should stop talking.
No, it's okay. We were talking about Jack Kornfield's book, After the Ecstasy, The Laundry.
The Laundry. I'm here doing my laundry.
And listening to you is ecstasy. It's very generous of you to share your personal story of your spiritual journey and how the Enneagram impacted, and also the things you've been saying, I think, are very clarifying and grounding for people. And
I hope so. Thank you.
And I wonder now, Richard, we can see how many of these we can get to, but I think it would be really beautiful for people if you might speak a little bit to how the Enneagram helps us broaden our experience of God, like the different types. What I know you've written about it.
Well, let me start with this. This is in my book, The Naked Now. I am convinced that a way to describe what we mean by the contemplative mind or the mystical mind is you begin to see things in a non-dual way. And I know a lot of Western people don't like that word. They think it's from the East somehow. Actually, we just, in the Catholic world, we had the word unitive consciousness. It was saying the same thing in a positive way, not non-dual, but unitive. When you begin to see things in wholes, instead of pulling out the part that you like and eliminating the part you don't like or that part of anything which threatens you, you are a dualistic thinker. And I'm afraid most of the Western world is highly dualistic. Forgive me for being so absolute. I'm probably sounding like a one. But I think our recent election cycle showed that you can be a university-educated person in the United States of America. You can have gone to church all your life, and when push comes to shove, when your privilege or ego is threatened, you revert to highly dualistic thinking. I know if I ever, even in the last year, appeared in a sermon or a talk or even with some friends to be taking sides, instead of countering the issue that I was addressing, they would always quote, "Well, are you for the other candidate?" That's the only way they can think. Are you saying the other candidate is better? Do you see the dualistic mind at work there? It doesn't address the issue. It simply takes sides. And if we don't get beyond this, we're in trouble. Now, I want to say very strongly that it was the Enneagram beginning in 1973, without realizing it, and I wasn't using that word at that time, that began to teach me how to operate psychically in a non-dual way. And that's no small gift, because until you rewire your consciousness and you stop dividing the field of the moment into what's good and what's bad, and invariably making one side totally good and the other side totally bad, you just can never come to wisdom. And as I saw, which I started to describe to you earlier, that my gift was my biggest problem. And my biggest problem was the foundation of my gift. And I couldn't have one without the other. That is emblazoned in my psyche now. I remember Ron Rollheiser, a priest friend, he heard me addressing a crowd some years ago, and he said, "Richard, you only have one idea." I said, "Really, what is it?" And he was trying to be nice to me, but he said, "You see everything in terms of both and." And I said, "That is a compliment. Thank you." He says, "You're obsessed with it, of self-balancing, which is a one characteristic. Why we ones are usually considered reasonable people, because we love to self-balance. But it, in many ways, was taught to me through the tool of the Enneagram. Then I was able to go back and read the Catholic mystics and my own Father Francis and the other Thomas Merton kind of people who've influenced me, and I realized that's how they all thought. That's why they could love their enemies. That's why they could counter the dominant consciousness of their time or their religion or their era without throwing it out. You know, they never overreacted. They always acted. And so the tool of the Enneagram is a tool for pure action. Sort of like, you know, the Hindus were taught in the Bhagavad Gita, how to act without reacting, without pushing your energy through the field. So I know it's helped me live that way and, frankly, be a much happier person the last 30 years of my life. And I hope it's helped me do that for others, each in their own way, of course, because, as you all well know, we're trapped in different ways. And even that gives us a kind of compassion, because to recognize, gosh, look what it's taken me to begin to break out of my own prison. And so I had better be very compassionate and very patient with my brothers and sisters, recognizing they're still trapped in their two-ness or their seven-ness or whatever it might be. So, I can't overestimate the importance of the Enneagram for helping me be what I hope has been a good teacher and a good spiritual director. I hope.
Beautiful. So you seem to be saying, too, that the Enneagram then is a natural way that prevents us, actually, if we're embracing the nine different expressions of it, there isn't a way to actually be dualistic because, for instance, maybe
Yes. You
begin to understand that there is no real love, maybe type 2 without the power of type 8, or there's no real clarity of type 5 without the joy of type 7, and that all of these things are intertwined, that you can't really separate them out. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, if I'm going to call God, as I did at the beginning, you know, the interior binding force of the universe, it allows you to see things in their wholeness. You know, the very word part we use, parts only make any sense when we recognize that they are indeed parts, which the very word implies. So that should drive you back to, well, what are they parts of? What is the whole? And the example you just used, you know, the arrow between the 2 and the 8 or the 5 and the 7. Here we have a relational universe. You heard me, and I'm not trying to push the Christian doctrine of the Trinity on anybody, but our real Orthodox belief is that God is relationship itself. Now, most Christians don't know that, but they should. If God is relationality itself, if God is an event of communion, then it should be no surprise that you and I, as fellow parts of the Enneagram typology, we do not live as an island, as an isolated person. But we live in communion with the energy, the balancing, the critique of the other, all eight numbers, really. Because, you know, many people have said that to me when I taught it to groups over the years. Well, I see a little bit of all eight, nine of them in me. And I said, yep, that's really true. And that's why we, in the Christian world, some of us identified the anagram with the historic capital sins. And we were all told that we all commit all, we had seven or eight capital sins. We always missed fear, which is the biggest one of all. That's the great irony. But it's in the historic listing of the capital sins, maybe you know or don't know that, fear was never named a problem, let's just put it that way, or a capital sin. Because you can't see the air you're breathing, you know. We're so fear-based, and politicians and clergy so build on fear, that we take fear as normative. And that, of itself, what I just said, is one of the greatest gifts of the anagram, to recognize that fear is a head trip, and fear is probably the most common of all of the nine types. And to add, as a scripture person, the most common one-liner in the Bible is do not be afraid. Do not is hands down said in the Bible more than anything else. And yet, we've tried to motivate our people by making them afraid of God, afraid of themselves, afraid of the outsider. And it's pretty sad.
It is very sad. And in many ways, I think that you're talking about point six, of course, where fear is the deep suffering, and it's like this free-floating fear. It can be attached to anything.
Yes, shapeless.
And in many ways, the other eight types, I think they're just flavors, different flavors of fear. You know, it's like different things that you're afraid of.
Wow, that's a great insight. I like that. And I could make an argument for what you just said. Yes, different flavors of the underlying fear that we all live in, a radical fragility, insecurity, dis-ease, if you will. Yeah, thanks for saying that.
So I wonder, you've been so generous about sharing a little bit about the one journey, because you're a one, but I wonder if you might just take one or two of the other types and just say a little bit about the sort of the quality of God, if you will, that type is representing, and then what the challenge might be for that journey.
Yes. Okay, let me try. And thanks for connecting it to the image of God, because you're attracted and disattracted to a certain image of God. Like my type, a lot of ones became clergy because we're attracted to law and order, you know, and being reasonable. And we use the gospel to create an ordered universe, which isn't the gospel at all, actually. But anyway, we all do that. Let me run to the seven, perhaps because I have so many seven friends, because they're so good for me. I'm so overly serious, and they're so overly lighthearted. I just love to have sevens around me to loosen me up. But by the same token, both as an employer, we have almost 40 people on our staff here now, and we're 30 years old this year. So I've gone through a lot of employees, a lot of personnel issues, as you do, and relationships with friends, too. I've come to see both what I just said about the seven, how I love their lightheartedness, their joy, and yet I've come to see also their lack of discipline, their over need to pleasure themselves with traveling and eating and all the rest of that. And I've seen how it undoes them. It undoes them and keeps them from sometimes a deeper sense of conscience, social justice, the hard issues. They often, as soon as you talk with any degree of profundity, they lose interest. I have one dear friend who says, whenever I write a new book, he says, are there going to be pictures in it finally? And of course, he's making fun of himself. But there's almost a temptation, I want to say it strongly, a temptation towards superficiality. In fact, a lot of us over the years who gave a lot of Enneagram workshops, we found, I don't know if this rings true to you, but the numbers who least showed up for workshops were sevens and threes, who are the most subject to superficiality. So they don't necessarily go deep in the inner journey, usually without suffering forced on them in some way or another, because they'll avoid it by every means possible. So they can avoid the whole inner journey, let's just put it that way, by remaining on the surface of life and, in terms of your good question, even on the surface of God. Naturally, if God was presented as an eternal torturer, well, a seven wants nothing to do with God. Until they can hear that God is the very nature of their being, the one in whom they live and move and have their being, they probably won't have much serious interest in religion or God. They'll keep it pretty superficial. So I could say that about the seven, but indirectly I could say it about the three, too, who's just doing it for different motives, because they're getting their juice from climbing. They're getting their juice from succeeding. They're getting their juice from looking good. And that gives you so much juice when you can get away with it in America. But imagine, I remember counseling a three in the slums of India. I'm not making this up. A poor boy who had that same success drive, efficiency drive, but had almost no ability to ever carry it out. Now, he became a somewhat profound three, but boy, was he forced there against his will. So I don't know if those are two descriptions that might be helpful.
Well, that was very poignant, what you said about staying on the surface of God. It's the three and sevens may do that, but the three and seven in all of us, you know, that is
That's one
of our spiritual challenges, right?
Very good. Yes, yes.
So, you know, when you talk about going deeper into below the surface of God, you might, you know, if we were just generalizing, think more about type 4 or, you know, type 5 or type 2, I don't know. So I wonder if you might pick one of those types and say something about it.
Well, since we talked about superficiality, let's talk with the 4 and the 5 about the danger of too much interiority, too much individualism, too much going inside and staying there, you know, into my own fantasy world, into my own specialness, into my own observations. So much so that, I mean, we've all met fives who have very poor social skills. They don't even know how to reach out or how to give a pleasant smile or how to be part of a group conversation. They got to sit against the back wall, you know. And forgive me for being so hard, but we've got to hear this to get the point. And we've all seen the same with the four. We love their immense creativity, but their need to go inside and be authentic, according to their definition of authentic, becomes obsessive after a while and keeps them from, again, being part of the team, part of the hoi polloi, we said in Greek, the common dance, or the general dance, as Thomas Merton would have put it. Do you always have to be an individual? Do you always have to be special? Couldn't you just once sit in the circle with everybody else? No, I have to sit on the floor or against the back wall. Do you understand? You can see the examples I'm using because I've taught in groups. And, of course, I can spot the fours right and the fives right at the beginning by the very way they place themselves or do not place themselves in the circle. That becomes a real narcissism. I don't know what else to say. But a narcissism they can't see. And so that's what a good spiritual director, especially a terrible one spiritual director like me, has to use those examples so they can, if I can use the other terrible expression, so they can weep over their sins too, to see that this is keeping them from love. And of course, that's what all nine of our types are doing. They're not just, as you said, flavors of fear, but they're all avoidances of love. And, well, if that's the whole meaning of life, and I, as a Christian, believe it is the whole meaning of life, if you're missing out on how to give love and how to receive love, then you're not in the general dance. That's a term from Thomas Merton. And, of course, he was a four with a five wing. I don't know if you know that. And one reason he could write as well as he did was because of that interiority. And that's why he went off to the monastery in Kentucky, to be special, to be an individual. But then he fought his way out of that paper bag by caring immensely, and we see this in his writings, about the wars of the world, the suffering of the world, the stupidity of most politics. And it was precisely his position in a hermitage in Kentucky that, you know, sort of like Wendell Berry enjoys also from Kentucky. That detachment from the game, physical detachment from the game, gave both Merton and Wendell Berry, or still gives Wendell, a tremendous liberating eye. And I think that eye on the situation, and I as a person too, both eyes. That was meant to be the function of a monk. I live in a little hermitage here myself in New Mexico. I'm looking out the front window here as I talk to you. And I couldn't write my books if I didn't have this certain degree of detachment from the system, the church system, the American system, not in a sense of superiority, I hope, but just some calm, compassionate observation that from this perspective, so much that our country is doing, and I'm looking over at the church across the parking lot of far ways, even so much that the church does, appears to me to be a massive waste of time. And I hope that doesn't sound too cruel, but it's just, it's almost a way to keep you on the surface. It's a Sunday morning, the cars are driving in for the next Mass in a little bit. These are sweet, good people. I had the Mass last night at 4:30, sweet, good people. But often I have to say that going to church is a way not to go deep, to make yourself think you've done something without really doing anything that matters. And I know I'm sounding terribly like a one, but that was all meant to be a commentary on the dangers of four and five. We Catholics appealed a lot to the four artistic type because of our statuary and our art and our incense and our candles and our vestments and our music. Fours have always loved the Catholic and Orthodox Church. And fives, who love to get into words and ideas, they really bought into Protestantism. You know, the study of the Bible, words and ideas. But I think both of us are now being roundly critiqued. And one way of critiquing it, only one, there's other ways for sure, but is to see that there was a lot of fourness in the Catholic world, and there was a lot of fiveness in the Protestant world. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah.
Not that it was wrong, but it was too much of a good thing as a bad thing. And that's the wisdom of the Enneagram.
It is the wisdom of the Enneagram. Is so just, we could go on and on. One thing,
yes.
As we're coming to a close here, I just want to say that the way that you described, for instance, the four, I think the four in all of us, this is one of the biggest challenges of real surrender, the real inner work, as you said, but
ultimately
we could call it surrender, is that we all have this little part, no matter what our type
is,
it just may be more with the four, that we want to be an individual. We want to be this false authentic, and we're actually afraid that if we surrender completely, we'll lose our individuality and we'll lose our sense, you know. And nothing could be further from the truth, isn't
exactly
it? So that God actually uses us better when we're more surrendered,
Well put, very well put, yes. But the ego doesn't want to know that. The ego doesn't want to surrender to that. Thank you.
Richard, this has just been an absolute treat. This is the keynote lecture of this day that's called Spirituality, Horizons, and the Boundlessness in the Enneagram. So, so Richard, thank you so much. This has been a blessing and a real blessing.
Well, Jessica, to talk to people like you is a blessing. So you asked good questions, and that allowed me to say some okay things. Thank you.
Thank you.
God bless. Bye. Bye to everybody there. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for the Enneagram Global Summit, brought to you by the Shift Network. To add this powerful collection of teachings to your personal library, visit enneagramglobalsummit.com/upgrade. To join our global community of people awakening to their divine humanity and taking inspired action, visit theshiftnetwork.com. Thank you again for gathering with us and for sharing this empowering path with your friends and family.